That Podcast Thing presents Home Movie Club, originally recorded May 2017. Episode number 5, You Pick Your Feet Where?
You're listening to Home Movie Club, and we've been watching 1971's highest-grossing movie, The French Connection. Starring Gene Hackman and Roy, we're gonna need a bigger boat, Scheider. The film, based on real-life events, is famous for its morally ambiguous cops, fashion faux pas, car chases, and its gritty, grimy description of early 1970s New York. But what did our band of morally ambiguous co-hosts think of the film? As always, I am delighted to say that I am joined by Joe Carter.
Who are you calling morally ambiguous?
Joe Carter. Daisy Swaffer.
Totally morally ambiguous, hello.
And Sammy Kelsch.
I am the most morally ambiguous person you know.
It is very, very true. So, any opening thoughts? Joe?
Yes. So, I had absolutely no idea what to expect from this film, French Connection. I thought maybe it was going to be a love story.
Oh no.
So not a love story.
Yeah, so I sort of started watching it and... You know, it started off and, you know, I wasn't really paying a great deal of attention. And then suddenly there was a Santa Claus, and then suddenly the Santa Claus was chasing someone down. So I had to rewind back to the beginning and start again paying more attention. I was like, I have no idea what's going on. So it was not what I expected. It wasn't bad. There were some really cool bits in it, but yeah, totally not what I went into and expected.
I'm so sorry we didn't warn you that it's not a love story.
Well, to be fair, I probably should have looked it up, but I kind of like going into these things blind.
Yeah.
Yes, no, I'm sorry, but that was definitely not a love story. Daisy?
I had forgotten this film entirely, and so it was wonderful to get a reminder as to what it was that I love about this movie. And yes, there's quite a bit that I love about this movie.
Cool. And Sammy?
I really, for some reason, thought that I'd seen this movie before, and I don't think I actually have. I think the reason that I was confused was that I'd seen a comparison of the car chase scene in this and the car chase scene from Bullet, which I definitely have seen.
Yes, no.
So I knew there was car chasey bits in it.
I hadn't seen it at all, and although I had a fairly good idea what it was about, i.e. not a love story, I wasn't sure what to expect either. Although one of the slight downsides of doing this podcast is I do try and do a bit of research before we do the film, so I kind of knew a little bit what was happening before it happened because I'd read synopses and stuff. Just to spoil it for everybody else who hasn't seen this film, and I'll be honest, if you haven't seen this film, what are you doing listening to this podcast?
Go Unless watch the film. Unless you don't mind spoilers. If you don't mind spoilers, then by all means, listen to us and then decide if you want to watch it for yourself. Mm.
Yes, this will be highly spoilerific, so if you don't want to be spoiled for the film and haven't seen it, then press pause, go and spend the next hour and 40 minutes watching it, and then come back to us. Mm. It'll be worth it. The film, that is, not necessarily the podcast. The plot. Film begins, appropriately enough, in Marseille, France, where an undercover detective, who is following the movie's main bad guy, Alain Charnier, played by Fernando Rey, comes to an untimely end when he is summarily shot in the face by Charnier's hitman, Pierre Niccoli.
Wasn't that a lovely blood splatter when that happened?
I did love how Niccoli stole the end off the unnamed detective's French baguette after murdering him.
And then drops the baguette on the body in, like, the ultimate French insult.
Although I'm not sure I'd actually want the baguette, to be honest. I mean, its previous owner just had his brains redistributed all over Marseille, and potentially all over the baguette too, so, you know, a little bit.
That's how evil he is. That's how you know he's a bad guy.
He's so evil he doesn't mind eating the slightly stained blood from a dead person.
Yep.
I didn't really know what was going on here.
No, there wasn't a lot to explain anything. It kind of relied on you understanding afterwards that this guy was something slightly more than just a random dude who shot someone in the face. Because at this point, there was no explanation of what was happening.
Yeah, that's okay, because I was like, am I supposed to know who this person is? How do we know it's a cop?
Yeah, I never knew that guy was like an undercover detective. I was just like, oh, okay, so this dude is like the French hitman man, and so I will think of him as hitman man.
In another part of Marseille, we have Charnier discussing legitimate business propositions before taking a boat out to Château d'If, an ancient island fortress just off the coast of Marseille. He meets up with Nicole and they discuss the involvement of television personality Henri Devereaux in their plan to smuggle $32 million worth of heroin into the United States. Devereaux is to be unwitting mule, believing that all Charnier wants is for him to take a car to the States, oblivious to the fact that there'll be 120 pounds of heroin hidden underneath the door foot plates of the car. Mm. That's a huge spoiler.
Yes, because I totally missed that at the beginning. Yeah. I knew they were duping him, but it wasn't until later on in the film that I was like, oh, that's where it is. Mm-hmm.
I don't know if they actually specifically said where the heroin was hidden.
Okay, fair enough.
So that's more of a spoiler of me telling you this here now than actually in the film itself.
Spoilers!
Well, we have already done the spoiler warning, so...
We need a spoiler horn.
We switch from the bright sunshine of Marseille to the gritty, grim and unrelenting greyness of a New York winter. Mm-hmm. A haggard-looking Father Christmas stands outside a bar in the cold, asking children what they want for Christmas. In the bar, we see a vice cop intimidating patrons. One of the patrons runs for it, out of the front door and past Father Christmas, who is revealed to work for the narcotics department as well, as he joins the chase for the fleeing patron. The patron slashes at the plainclothes cop's arm with a knife before running off. They chase him for several blocks before he stumbles over rough ground and receives a vicious beating by the two police officers, Jimmy Popeye Doyle and Buddy Cloudy Russo, Gene Hackman and Roy Scheider, respectively.
You forgot the singing.
Singing?
Yeah.
I tried to forget the singing because it was kids singing and that's just terrific.
But that was the whole signal for the other dude to go.
Well, yes, him ringing his bell, it was the sort of, yeah.
I thought that was really cute. The little kids were kind of cute.
They were small children, certainly.
We should probably mention that this film is based on a book which is based on an actual case, and this duo, cop duo, were a real life duo who also appear in the film. And that Santa Claus thing was a thing that they did in real life, and they caught loads of people around Christmas time using it, so it worked.
That's really cool. Daisy dropping the knowledge bombs.
Yep, Daisy's done the research.
Yeah.
I do trivia.
Yeah. I also thought it was cool that they were a bunch of black kids, because I thought that held true to the fact that, you know, it was in Brooklyn, New York. So that was really awesome.
A very diverse city, which is great.
Yes, so needless bit of police violence there. He's dragged to a side alley where he's given a further beating and arrested.
When they're beating the guy up, one of them is, like, asking him actual questions, while the other one, Popeye, is asking him really weird stuff. Like, have you been to Poughkeepsie? Do you pick your feet there?
I'll be honest, I didn't understand any of that.
Well, that's because it's also based on the real-life actual cop duo. What they would do is one of them would be asking the actual proper questions, and the other one would be asking just really left-field, what-on-earth questions. And with them firing these questions at a suspect, then they just get really kind of flustered and confused by those weird left-field questions and end up answering the ones that they did know the answers to, the ones that would then just incriminate them because they were about the actual criminal act. So
yes,
that was an actual tactic that they used.
Yeah, the question is, did you ever pick your feet in Poughkeepsie?
I assume Poughkeepsie is some area or part of New York.
Yes.
So they clock off for the night. Doyle convinces Russo to go for a drink. They're in the bar and we have the 3 Degrees, the actual 3 Degrees singing as a bar act, which I didn't realise was the 3 Degrees.
They were really good.
Well, yeah, the 3 Degrees are quite good. I believe they were reasonably, you know, successful.
Yeah, I looked up who they were because it was like they're spending a lot of screen time on them singing and they appear to be pretty good, so they're probably some well-known people.
Yeah, I didn't realise it was them until the credits at the end, but it was like, oh, it's the 3 Degrees. There you go.
Excellent musicking, ladies.
I couldn't actually name a single 3 Degrees song, so sorry, 3 Degrees.
If you're listening, we like you. And we respect you, and you did a good job.
And why are you listening to this rubbish? They're in the bar. Doyle is obviously a cop that never clocks off, noticing a group of patrons that are spending money like water. Decide to watch the club from the outside and follow one of the pairs of partygoers back all over New York, following them. They switch cars, they follow them. I didn't pick up why they picked that particular pair to follow. Did I miss something there, or was it just a random they picked that pair?
They look suspicious.
True.
I think it was to do with the fact that they were spending lots of money. He was flashing around cash, and that obviously that was quite unusual back then. I think he described him as a greaser. I guess that's the kind of person that greases the wheels with money.
Yes, I suspect that's, yeah. We end up with a situation where they start staking out the pair at the diner.
With a straw boater on the back.
Yes, the sign that it's an undercover policeman doing undercover work. A straw boater on the back seat of the car, or in the back windowsill of the car.
Really?
I assume to... Yep.
Yeah, I had to look that up afterwards as well, because I was like, they've like shown this shot particularly, why? And then they did it again later in the movie, and they never explained that, but yeah, when you actually go and look it up, that's why.
Yeah, I think it's a sign to other policemen to basically do not disturb, because they're undercover policemen on a job.
Mm-hmm.
Which, if you know that, makes sense. If you don't know that, then obviously you wouldn't necessarily notice the detail.
And hopefully the criminals don't know that, otherwise they get made.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Yeah. Like, having a sign like that, yeah, okay, it's going to stop the police from driving up and bothering you, but surely it's not going to take actual criminals long to cotton on to that.
No. So, yeah, they discover that both Sal Bocca and his wife Angie have criminal records now. Sal Bocca and Angie, obviously the owners of the diner. There's lots of scenes of them following them and staking out the joint. In fact, there's an awful lot of this film that is just them staking people out. It's not a lot happens for quite a lot of time.
Yeah, about half the movie is like, okay, is there even any criminal activity going on? There's not really a lot happening.
There's a lot of shouting and lots of angry bosses from the impression that I got. But as I said, I kept on getting all of the men confused.
Their direct report in the police department, the person who was like shouting at them for not getting stuff done and things, that is one of the two cops that the real life cops that the thing's based on.
Yes, the both of the two real life police were in this film in one form or another. In fact, there's an awful lot of people in this film that are either ex-cops or other sort of people of note. We'll get to them as we come to them, but certainly a lot of people in this film were either actually there at the time that the original book was from, or you know, were involved in some way. So they're following Sal around, and they actually follow him to the apartment building of a known drug financier, Joel Weinstock. Now this is the thing, because this basically links this small-time crook to a bigger criminal element. Then we get the scene where, in an attempt to gather information, they raid a bar that is known to be frequented by drug users and dealers.
Yeah, is this the scene where they beat up all the black men and I got really uncomfortable?
Yeah.
So I didn't really know what was going on and why they decided to go there, but it just looked really racially motivated, which was
I'm pretty sure wrong. It was Gene Hackman did say that he had a real problem with all the racist things that he had to say and things in this film.
Why didn't he just refuse to do it, take a stand?
Because it's kind of historical, isn't it? It's actually what happened. I mean, it's loosely historical, admittedly, but and the whole point of the scene was that they went in and they were confronting the bar owners and the bar patrons. But the real point of it was that he wanted to get this particular patron into the back restrooms. And that sounds really dodgy when I say it like that.
That sounds extremely dodgy when you say it like that.
So yeah, basically he picks on this patron and forces him back into the restrooms to confront him. However, this is actually Doyle's informant. And this is the whole point of this charade, is that although they are there to, you know, bust some heads and make some small-time arrests, the whole point of this is it's a big show so that the informant doesn't get pointed out as being anything other than just another patron.
That makes sense. That makes sense, yeah.
Yeah, because he wants to speak to him, but he can't just wander up and say, oh, do you want to come to the back toilet with me and spend...
Well, of course.
Sounds slightly dodgy.
They can't have his cover blown, otherwise he wouldn't be used as an informant and he'd probably end up dead.
That's a lot of the ruse of this, is simply to do that. They speak to the informant and he says there's little or no action happening, but there is talk of a large quantity of drugs coming into the city soon, although details are sparse. Yeah, so that was the whole point of that scene, was simply to get the information from the informant without raising suspicion. This really sort of slim piece of information is enough for Doyle and Russo to take it to their commanding officer and ask for a wiretap of Sal Bocco's shop and his apartment. I think dubiously their captain agrees to the wiretap on the provision that Doyle and Russo will work with two FBI agents, who are, I believe, Agents Mulderig and Klein.
Oh, Mulder and Scully, yeah.
Yeah, not Mulder and Scully, because yes. Mulderig, Doyle, obviously, there is this thing that these two have a history, there's some serious friction between the two of them. Although I don't think the details ever really fleshed out about what the problem is, other than I think Muldrick accuses Doyle of his past.
We've had a couple of references to the last time he had a hunch kind of things, and that when last time he was dead certain there was a dead cop.
Yes,
and there's like two or three references to this, so obviously yeah.
It's never actually
we don't hear the story, but
it's implied more than anything.
Yeah, there's friction there because of it, and that's understandable.
Yeah,
they mostly agree because this Weinstock guy is someone that they've been after for a while, so it doesn't matter if his hunch doesn't pan out because they've got a legitimate excuse to wiretap.
Yeah. So we see Henri Devereux arrive in New York, watches his car is unloaded from the ship. It's a nice brown, old-fashioned car. Also watching are Shane and Nicole, who have recently arrived in New York. I think they were supposedly to arrive by air, certainly on a separate method than the ship that Henri arrived in. But several days of wiretapping, finally, Doyle and Russo overhear Sal Bocca arranging meetings with a Frenchman. Now, from what I understand, France is one of the main routes of drugs into New York in the 70s, which is why this is sort of significant that he is French. So they continue trying to follow Sal. They follow Sal's car and then nearly lose him on the Brooklyn Bridge when there's a big traffic jam, which apparently they didn't get permissions for and they just filmed by having someone actually just stop in the way and make the traffic jam happen.
Well, they had a really small budget for this film. The same as Rocky, actually, $2 million. So they didn't build any sets, they did everything on location, and there was a lot of times they didn't have permits for things.
Yeah, so from what I understand, the fact that they were working with ex-policemen smoothed a lot of ruffled feathers and actually smoothed the way a lot for them to actually make this film. But they managed to follow Sal to the Roosevelt Hotel, where Sal meets up with Charnier and Nicole. And again, we get another...
Oh God, but then it's got the tension music, and the tension music that's the most awfully offending my ears music in the world, where it's just this screeching, clashing, oh God, it goes on forever. I hated, like, there wasn't much score in this film, but I really hated what score there was, because it was like, oh, here is tension by torturing your ears.
It was such stressful music.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, as you said, there wasn't a lot of soundtrack to this, but what there was very discordant and yeah, no.
But I mean, obviously the idea was to make it sound tense and stressful because the situations were tense and stressful.
It didn't need to be kind of that offensive to our ears for that long, because whenever it did have this screechy, tense music, it just went on for ages.
Yes, unfortunately, going on for ages could describe the following scenes where they're following Nicole and Shania around. They've got the whole sitting, watching them eat at a restaurant and following them around town. And somehow they managed to find out Shania's name from asking a hotel reception. I'm fairly sure if you did that today, you would get told to...
I'm sure he flashed his badge.
Yeah.
Well, we didn't see him flash his badge, but yeah, I guess.
We didn't see him get an answer either, so I'm sure when the dude answered going, no, then he will have shown him his badge.
Yeah, fair enough. We see Sal bringing a sample of the newly smuggled heroin to Weinstock, who has his chemist test the purity of the heroin, and that was actually real heroin they were testing in an official way of how you actually testing it. Apparently announcing that the heroin was top quality stuff.
They had a small budget for this film, yet somehow they managed to buy actual real heroin for it.
Real high quality heroin as well, potentially.
Yeah, it would have been cheaper to just use baby powder.
I suspect they got it via their police contacts.
From the evidence locker.
Yes, yeah. I'm not saying it was when the police were dealing drugs. Just to clarify that situation. So they agree that the quality of the drugs coming in is very high. Sal wants to make a quick deal, fearing Charnier will basically take his business elsewhere. But Weinstock knows Sal is under the watchful eye of the police and wants to take things a bit more carefully.
Yeah, I was surprised that Sal knew that his phones were being tapped, because he didn't seem to be acting like his phones were being tapped.
Yeah, I was wondering if I'd missed something at that point as well, because it didn't seem to follow that everybody seemed to know that they were being watched by the FBI and being watched by the police.
I think it was because the people that were watching them weren't being particularly subtle.
Oh God, they were so bad at following. It was just worse.
There were lots of times when the tails were blatantly obvious. Now, I'm wondering if that was blatantly obvious because they had lots of shots where you had to get both the tailie and the person being tailed in the same shot. And...
The tailor?
Well,
But they'd, like, accidentally into them or just suddenly be like, oh, hi, I'll have a brief conversation with you now instead of surreptitiously standing on the other side of the street where you can't see me.
Yeah, I'm not sure it was the most so accurate bad. Representation of how you tell someone.
In the cars and on the streets and everywhere, they were just awful at following. And I don't know if maybe that's a reflection that the actual real cops were maybe terrible at following. But oh, oh God, no. It was just like, oh, I'm sure I could do better than this and I have no training in it.
I think it was more a reflection of the need for the cinematics and actually to get these people in shots at the same time. Because as I said, a lot of this was done in a guerrilla style. There was, you know, one or two camera shots at the most and it was all done.
Well, the result was that they came across looking incompetent at following people.
Yes. Yeah.
True. We get Doyle spotting Charnier on the street. I think from that the case was that it was supposedly that Charnier was being watched in his hotel by the FBI.
Yeah.
And yet the FBI were also equally incompetent because
he walked straight past them. From them.
Yeah.
Yep. He's following Charnier, but oddly enough, Charnier spots him. Shocking. And manages to evade by jumping on and off subway cars.
Oh, that was hilarious. It was
love the beautiful subway dance.
Musical chairs. It was just like, I'm going to go on and I'm going to subtly go off and I'm going to grab this woman just to see, like, I'm, you know, what did
I... Oh, look, I need to throw something in the rubbish bin. Yes. Oh, now I'm going back on the train again.
Yes, and look, oh, I have a
cane
in the thing, and oh, I'm going to have a fake phone call and a real phone call and have a fake conversation and buy a drink. And it was just hilarious. I was watching this when I was eating my lunch and I was just kind of giggling to myself.
That's my favorite scene in the whole movie is the beautiful subway dance.
Yeah,
that's
it was just brilliant.
I'm not sure it was supposed to be a French farce or possibly a French Connection farce, but it certainly came across as that.
Yeah,
and that little wave as he goes.
Doyle gets given the slip as Charnier just rides off in a subway car waving goodbye. The thing with it now is that Charnier knows he's being followed by the police
and knows exactly what he looks like.
And knows exactly who he is, what he looks like.
Yeah.
So when Sal wants to meet again, he agrees, but only if he flies to Washington to do so. I assume that's a jurisdiction thing. The New York police can't follow them to Washington.
And they showed us very clearly that they were in Washington with a nice wide shot with the White House in it. And it's like,
White House,
oh, yes,
and the Lincoln Memorial. And
yes.
Yep. We are indeed in Washington. Of course, the NYPD can't follow, but Klein, who is FBI, could.
Yeah.
So he follows and sees Charnier and Sal meeting. Mm-hmm. Now, from what I saw of that, he was a good 200 meters away looking through a pair of binoculars.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure he could actually hear anything that was being said. I don't quite know what that gained them.
He knew that they met.
Yeah, Sal meets with Charnier, asks for more time because Weinstock wants to move slowly. But because of the growing interest, the police interest in him, Charnier wants to make the deal and leave the States as soon as possible. On the flight back to New York, and this flight was fantastic because they had an area at the back of the flight where you just lounged around. Yeah.
That was clearly first class.
I mean, 1970s airlines were obviously a completely different world.
It looked like the lap of luxury.
Yeah, you could buy a ticket, you know, just on the door and fly off.
Just walk up and get a $50 ticket, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, just write your name down here. Okay.
Yeah, just print your name on both. And there's no security. It was a different time, obviously. So they're flying back to New York. Nicole offers to kill Doyle, but Charnier advises against it because even if Doyle is killed, another policeman will simply take his place.
There are many policemen in New York.
Yeah.
Yes. Although, as Nicole said, come Friday, they'll be leaving anyway. So this is the ironic bit, is that because there's been no progress, Doyle and Russo are pulled off the case and the investigation's closed. Now, this bit was done in... I didn't get why this was being done at the scene of a car crash.
Yeah, that... I got very confused with this.
I wondered if maybe it's because your time is needed on other cases and other stuff's going on and so you need to be working on other things rather than...
But they are narcotics police, so they wouldn't be dealing with road traffic accidents anyway.
Yeah.
It was just one of... there was two or three points through this film where there didn't seem to be an awful lot of point for the actual scene.
Mm.
And you could almost argue the very first scene when the detective gets shot was unnecessary, but it did set up Pierre Nicoli as the hitman, so I guess that had a meaning. But there was a scene later on where we see Popeye Doyle basically pick up a woman off the street, which was another weird one that I didn't quite work out what was going on. And then we see him the following morning and he's been handcuffed to the bed with his own cuffs. Again, it didn't seem to make any sense why that was in there.
Yeah, that was really odd. I sort of blinked, and then there was, like, his partner was coming in and he was handcuffed to the bed. I was like, did the woman seduce him? Was it was just a random woman off the street? Okay.
Well, yeah, he was driving home and she was ahead of him on the bicycle, and then the next thing, then...
It didn't make an awful lot of sense within the film, or indeed, you know, outside of the film, about what this scene was trying to tell us. Or
the only thing I could take from it was the guy must be able to exude charm when he wants to have got that far that quick.
No offense to Gene Hackman, but he is hardly a Casanova.
Which is why I felt that they needed to have a scene to tell us, without showing us that he exudes charm.
Possibly.
It was an interesting choice, certainly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But this is the point where it could have all gone horribly wrong or horribly right for them. Because, obviously, they've been pulled off the case. The case is closed. So, you know, film over. Everybody gets away with it. End of story. But because Nicole basically ignores Charnier's word not to kill Doyle, and he tries to kill Doyle with a sniper rifle, the case is back on.
Oh, shoots a poor old lady.
He's not a very good shot with a sniper rifle. You'd think he'd be able to actually hit his target, wouldn't you?
I mean, that's one of the things I put in my notes, is that he takes a shot, he misses and kills a young mother pushing her pram next to Doyle.
Oh, I thought it was an old lady, but...
It might have been. We never actually saw it in detail. But it was the situation where, following the pedestrian and pretty much dull period of stakeouts and tails, the violence just seemed very brutal and shocking. It was very loud and very sudden.
Yeah, it was jarring.
It was jarring, but I suspect that was the whole point.
Yeah, 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 it's meant to be. And then he sort of hides behind a tree, which of course is... It was thinner than he was. It was like, yes, this tree is really going to protect you.
Well, it's fine, yeah, because the guy wasn't a good shot.
Yeah.
This is a trained hitman, and he can't hit someone, you know, walking slowly around
Well, I mean, a sniper rifle does take a certain amount of training.
Yeah.
He can hit them when they're stood in, like, little flat foyer and holding a stick of French bread.
Well, that was within about 2 foot.
And that was a handgun. So.
Sniper rifle, yes. And he's no good. So he's just not a very good hitman.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he shoots, he misses.
But he's good at getting off a roof fast.
He is. Yeah. So Doyle basically runs up the fire escape inside the building to get to the roof. Gets the roof, and there's no one there, but there's nothing left apart from...
the rifle and some bullet casings, which... Yeah,
rifle and spent shells left lying discarded. He frantically looks around until he spots someone down at ground level running away. And at that point, that struck me as a bit weird, because someone's just been shot. Someone running away from that doesn't seem that suspicious.
Unless he recognised him.
Well, he didn't really get to see him much. I mean, he had seen sort of Nicole quite a lot, because he'd been following around town for a long while.
Yeah.
But, you know, he didn't get a good look at him. In fact, through the entire sequence, he didn't get a good look at him.
Well, yeah, because he was just sort of, when he got to... Because Nicole ran away onto the subway platform and Popeye was on the other side. And he was just sort of scanning and looking at the people.
Yeah, so at that point, Nicole was hiding behind sort of girders and he got on a train. And
what you're failing to remember is what we've been told in the film, that Popeye Doyle has good hunches.
Ha.
Yeah.
He has intuition. Mm.
Basically, Nicole gets on a train and starts sort of sailing away as per all good escape methods in New York, apparently.
He didn't have a good hunch with which of the two train platforms to go to, though, did he?
No, because he got on the wrong one.
Well, that was a bit of a less good hunch, in fairness.
But it did lead to a great car chase.
Yeah,
it's a cars chase scene with only one car. I mean, that in itself is quite different.
It's a car chasing a subway train. It was quite cool.
Yeah.
So he sort of demands the next stop, doesn't he, from the conductor, and then runs down onto the road and tries desperately to get someone to stop.
Yeah, oddly enough, people aren't stopping when a man with a gun is trying to get you to stop your car. I can't blame him for that one.
The poor guy whose car he took. Because that car was totaled by the end.
And it was funny because...
I hope it was insured.
Yeah, it was funny because the guy was like, how am I supposed to get back?
Yeah.
Am I going to get my car back? No, you don't want it after this, mate.
Yeah.
So he's basically leaning on the horn, isn't he? And driving towards the next station.
Driving like a bit of a nutter towards the next station. He gets to the next station, but by this time... Nicole has shot a guard and basically is holding the driver
hostage. Cop. He shot the transit cop.
Was it the transit cop?
Yeah,
okay.
Transit cop, yeah.
Oh.
Shoots a transit cop and is holding the driver hostage.
Mm.
Fun fact, the driver of the subway is actually a subway driver. because legally you're not allowed to have someone who's not in the union to drive a subway car.
That's so cool.
So he was an actual subway driver. I'm assuming, you know, he was paid for doing the film as well, not just was driving a train.
Yeah, he was a very good actor.
Sure he was. He did a good job.
Nicole holds up the driver, or holds the driver hostage, forcing him to drive through the station. So you have the situation where, you know, Doyle gets to the next station, runs up to the bus, up to the station, and then he's sort of dismayed as the train just keeps going.
Yeah, so he runs furiously back.
Run
down.
Back down to the car.
Continue the car chase again.
Continue the chase. Hurrah!
Interesting fact: it's a Pontiac Le Mans. The car, apparently,
it was indeed a Pontiac Le Mans. I also read that the car itself could do about 90 miles an hour, which is faster than the train. So, you know, it could actually keep up with the train.
They did close off lots of sections of road for filming that car chase, but not quite all of the sections of road. Some of those hits and things were actual genuine collisions with actual people, and some of the stunt ones were meant to be near misses and they actually hit and things. So
yeah, I mean, I've read that, but I've read a few stories that seem to contradict themselves as well, that actually everybody driving was either a stunt driver or sort of an ex-policeman or a police driver. Mm. You know, from an insurance point of view, you wouldn't let civilians anywhere near a film set like that.
All of the cameramen were married with kids, so I think it was the director was the one who went on the back seat with the camera in order to do that filming, because he didn't have a wife and kids.
So unfortunately the stress of this has given the train driver a heart attack, so he slumps down and the train starts careering towards the train that stopped at the next station in front of them. Nicole, realizing the situation, starts to make his way back through a now empty train carriages. Oddly enough, the sight of a transit cop being shot and indeed a guard being shot is enough to make the other occupants run the other way. Yeah. So I assume they're at the other end of the train, conveniently out of the way of anything that's about to happen. The train crashes into the train in front, which is probably a fairly traumatic thing and a lot of kinetic energy, but it didn't seem to have an awful lot of effect. It was just sort of thrown around a bit.
I did wonder if maybe the driver slumping forward, he slumped onto the brakes or stopped.
Yeah, there may well be a dead man's brake, actually, thinking about it. And I think there was a little bit of sort of shots of braking.
Yeah.
So, okay, fair enough. We'll give them that. But one train definitely smashes. Well, one train is implied to smash into the other. They obviously couldn't afford to smash a subway car into another yes. subway car. So it was implied as opposed to shown. But the crash happens. Nicole, basically, having been in a train crash, sort of staggers out, tries to escape down the station steps, but spots Doyle, who Woody, looks equally shaken.
Popeye's right there waiting for him.
Right there waiting, but he looks about as beaten up as Nicole, I assume, from the rather sort of bumper car-esque drive across town.
He's been in quite a number of car crashes.
Bit stressful.
And didn't seem to have a seatbelt on, so surprised he survived at all.
1971.
Yep. They were built stronger back then. Mm. So Nicole tries to run downstairs and away, but spots Doyle. Doyle spots him. And in a controversial move, basically Doyle shoots Nicole in the back, killing him dead.
Yes, and then sort of slumps down on the stairs. I don't know whether he was shot. It was really
I
confusing.
Don't think he was shot. I think it was just because he was in several car crashes. And
probably a little bit exhausted at this point.
A little bit exhausted, probably a little bit shaken up.
That shooting him in the back moment was really like... If we hadn't have already known that there was... bad as well as good in this guy, then that said it all, really. Mm. Yeah, he was shooting a bad guy, but he shot him in the back.
Yes. Of course, the irony of this is the case is now back on because someone's tried to take a policeman's life, so they get to get reassigned to the case.
And it showed pretty decisively that they were onto something as well.
Absolutely, yes. So they keep following Sol around and watch him as he picks up Devereux's car.
When they were trying to find the car, Zol picked it up in the parking garage, and there was one of the guys was hanging around pretending that he lost his ticket, and then...
Part of their amazing ability to follow them surreptitiously.
Yeah,
just
exactly.
Just walked down and was speaking to him just openly.
Oh, I can't seem to find my ticket. Oh, God, what have I done?
Yeah. No, yes, they did. They basically, this is where they saw Devereux's car get picked up by Sol, was because he went to the parking garage and picked it up and drove off. And as you say, Roy Schneider's character, Russo, just walked in there like, oh, what's happening? Mm. And then walked straight into him and starts trying to make small talk.
Yeah. And then he tries to run after a car. And I was just thinking, dude, you can't.
Well, he ran out to his own car with Popeye Doyle and they started chasing.
It was just hilarious. It's like, you trying to outrun a car?
Yep. Follow him as he drops the car off and then stake out the car to see who pulls up. Cue a 5-minute sequence of people sitting in cars watching cars go past. Again, it seems to be one of those where things don't happen particularly quickly.
Well, they had that, we'll sit here all night if we have to, and then it cuts to the middle of the night.
4:30 in the morning, they're still sitting there.
Yeah, the real life stakeout for that actually lasted for 3 days.
Oh my God.
So we were spared that.
They didn't film that much.
Whoa.
Yeah, I mean, thankfully we didn't get to see that.
Okay, I was just going to say, I have a question about the car. Because there was a scene at the beginning where there was an auction where they bought this car because the number plate was very, you know, sort of iconic, or at least, you know, memorable. So they bought the car. Was that in New York?
No, the car they bought was in New York, was actually a different car.
Oh.
That was bought at auction, and that turns up later on in the story.
Oh, I got confused. I thought this was the car they were buying that had the drugs in.
No, this is the car that they're following, the brown sedan, was brought over from France.
Okay.
With the drugs in the foot.
I thought the car was plates black. Of the car.
No, it was dark brown.
It looked black to me. Okay, well, that's just my eyes. Nope. I was really confused.
The 70s, it was brown.
Yeah,
because I thought it had the numbers on the windscreen when they were taking up the plates in when they were in the barn.
No, that was that car, but that was slightly different. What they were doing with that was putting the money in there from the deal and then using that to get the money out.
Oh, I thought... Oh, so it wasn't the same car. No. Okay, I don't know cars, but yeah. I got a bit confused. I just wanted to check.
Yeah, they stake out the car and they see this really beaten up station wagon go past the car and then go around again and then eventually stop, and this gang all jump out and move towards the cars. Cue the sirens and the shouting police and the gunshots in the air.
Yeah,
and
they really did jump the gun on that one.
Mm. Yeah.
That was funny.
Yes, because...
A little bit.
It turns out these were just your run-of-the-mill car thieves.
Yeah.
So pretty much I think they just give up at this point and decide to bring the car in and strip it down to find the drugs themselves.
Yeah.
So they pull the car in. They strip it down to the bare metal but fail to find anything.
Like, I did not know that you could take a car apart that much, you know? Like, wow.
Well, yes. I mean, you can't put it back together again. That's the problem.
Yeah.
Well, you can, but...
You can give it a good go.
Well, they slashed it with a knife.
But they slashed the... So they took panels off and then slashed... what was behind the panels.
Oh, right.
So if the owner of the car took the panels off, it'd be instantly obvious that something had happened. But I guess the point being that if you just look at it, you may not notice anything.
Yeah.
So they pull the car apart, can't find anything at all. They're pretty much ready to give up.
But Popeye is like, I was so sure, there has to be.
Other fact of that one, the mechanic who was with them in there, the older grey-haired gentleman, was actually the mechanic in the case as well.
Oh, sweet.
So he is also one of the actual...
Irving someone or other, wasn't it?
He was one of the sort of players in the actual real-life drama that this was portraying.
I wonder what it would be like sort of reliving this stuff on film. For the actual people.
He was probably just in the garage and that's all he ever did. So it was just like a day at work, really, just with some cameras.
Yeah, so What's-His-Face was getting really frustrated because he was so sure that there were drugs in there. And then some bright spark pops up with, how much does the car weigh?
Yeah, so Russo notices that the car weight when it came in was 120 pounds more than the sort of the catalogue weight, so what the manufacturers say should be the weight of the car when it's new. Mm-hmm. And they're like, oh, it's 120 pounds heavier. There must be something in it.
Mm.
So they sort of go back over and go, well, what haven't we looked at? And then realise they hadn't taken...
I love the way, though, the guy is just like, but we've taken that car apart for everything except for the rocker panels.
And we're like, I'm like, of course, why didn't you just take the rocker panels off as well if you're going to take the whole thing apart?
Yeah. So they take the rocker panels off, which are the plates that go... at the bottom of the door frame, when you open the door, it's what you sort of stand on or scuff, so you don't scuff the carpet. They take those off and pull up the inner sort of lining, and yes, there they find...
Voila! The drugs!
Blue and green packets full of heroin.
Popeye does have good hunches.
Yep, so his hunch is correct. Obviously, at this point, Devereaux's worked out that his car's gone missing and has been basically sent to the garage where Doyle and Russo are working to recover his car. Now, because they've found the drugs, I assume their plan would be to return the drugs and the car back to Devereaux, which is what they do. They say, oh yes, it was towed, so we've got it here, it's all in perfect nick.
Yeah,
but they return the car back to him.
This was
and
really
they tell
weird.
Him it's pristine, and it's like, is that the same car if it's pristine?
Yeah.
They did a good job of putting it back together, certainly.
They must have.
Yeah, because they were like, oh, we've been waiting here 4 hours. But I mean, was the 4 hours, what part were they pulling the car apart? Because there's no way that the time between when they found the drugs and when he was whining about it being 4 hours was enough time to put the entire car back together.
Yeah, we don't know at what point in that whole process he arrived.
But even still, 4 hours is probably...
I almost had the impression that he turned up to reclaim his car while they were still sort of sitting around going, we can't find anything.
Yeah.
But I agree that the time didn't really seem to make a lot of sense in that way.
Well, I think it was just movie time. Everything gets done
absolutely.
Hand wavy.
Yeah, exactly. Hand wavy, you didn't see this Jedi thing.
Yeah. It's not the car you're looking for.
Yeah, that's the words.
So they present the car back to Devereaux.
But Henri is spooked and doesn't want anything more to do with Alain.
Yeah.
Yes, so he goes and speaks to Charnier and says, that's it, I'm out. Charnier offers him more money, but he refuses and just walks away.
Which is very sensible.
We're very sensible, but it also means that this next section, Charnier has to be the one driving the car to the drug pickup.
Yeah.
Which I'm sure wasn't his original plan.
Yeah.
But it means he is going to be there at the end. Because we're reaching the end of the film, thankfully.
Yeah.
Yay!
Though I have to say that I wasn't sort of going, oh my God, when is this film going to end this time? So I was intrigued enough to find out what happened.
I did think it dragged somewhat in the centre.
Oh, yeah,
when they were doing the stakeouts. But
as soon as the train chase came on, that I was just hooked.
Yeah,
I wanted to find out what
happened.
It
did certainly pick up pace. And you had the picking up of the pace music as well. So the fact that Henri has washed his hands of the whole affair means that Charnier has to drive the drug car to the exchange himself. So he drives across New York to an abandoned warehouse to meet with various drug dealers, including Sal. Drugs are basically pulled out of the car, verified and paid for.
Yeah, but there was tension. There was the whole, when he pulls back the thing, did they put the drugs back in? Did they replace them?
We didn't see.
You know, is there going to be some kind of, you know, snake popping out?
The science guy there testing the heroin.
Yeah, we were like, is that the right color? Is it going to be genuine? And it was like, ooh.
I loved the science. The science was great. I learned so much about drugs.
Yep.
It was cool.
I think the whole thing was that they had to basically let the drug deal go through.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you ended up with a bunch of guys who were hanging around a warehouse who hadn't actually done anything illegal.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they verified the drugs, drugs paid for. Store the drugs in the warehouse.
As soon as we saw Sal Boca celebrating, it was just like, oh
it's all
going to
go wrong.
Oh, yeah, so who were the two guys that were hugging? Because that was really sweet.
That was Sal and his brother, who had been seen a couple of times, but not very much.
Okay. Yeah, that was nice.
Yeah, that was really sweet. I thought they were a couple. So thinking of them as a couple, it made it really sweet.
No, they were. Then also,
oh,
they
brothers
also
are dead, also so. Sweet.
Yeah, I thought it was very progressive for 1971.
The drugs are stored in the warehouse, and the money. This is where the other car comes in. The money is placed under the footplates of the junker car.
Okay.
I assume so that they can somehow get that back over to France. So job done. Charnier drives back from the warehouse, but he crosses a bridge, and there's a police roadblock.
It's such a wonderful moment. It's like, this is the payoff we've been waiting for all movie. Here it is. That moment when they crest the bridge and they come down and there's just a wall of police.
Yeah.
Yep. So it is Charnier and the police, but because of the the sort of the angle of the bridge, it was shot in such a way that it seemed that the police just sort of almost rose up on the horizon of the bridge.
It was very dramatic.
And then yeah. Popeye does the little wave, just like the guy yep. had done on the subway to him.
Yeah.
And that was just a wonderful little mirror moment.
Yeah, that was brilliant. Was it Sol in the car with him?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was Sol Booker.
Yeah, I think maybe it was.
Yeah, it's Sol's driving Shania back to the city. So he panics and then turns around and they drive back and then everyone scatters and it's
drive
hilarious.
Back to the warehouse to cries of "He's coming back! What now?" Which I thought was quite amusing. And then you just hear a wall of sirens and a sort of a wall of police cars, sort of almost Blues Brothers esque, coming
yes.
towards them.
It's the Rozzers.
there's a very brief sort of firefight. Charnier runs to a different warehouse.
He runs in the opposite direction, whereas everyone else...
which is a sensible thing to
yeah.
do.
He's a criminal mastermind.
I just laughed at the one guy that sort of went over the wall and landed right in front of the police cars as they pulled up. I was like, you idiot. That's the wrong way.
I think that was actually Sol's brother as well. So.
Oh, dear.
So this police sort of stream into the compound and there's a brief gun battle and the dealers are either killed or arrested.
It's a shootout.
Yeah.
It's a shootout.
You've got to love a shootout that you're not actually watching. Yay.
Doyle spots Charnier escaping and follows him into the other warehouse. I think Sol makes a break for it, but then I think it's Sol that is killed by the shotgun blast from Rousseau.
Sol is killed in the gunfight, the first one, and then everyone surrenders.
Yeah, they throw smoke into the building and they all surrender.
Yeah, and then Popeye's gone off after Charnier or Frog One or whatever it was he was babbling yep. about, and he's sort of a little bit irrationally determined at this point, shall we say.
Yes. So the warehouse is dark and Rousseau catches up with Doyle and they both try and find Charnier. They spot a person walking through a doorway and Doyle just opens fire, empties his revolver into the target.
Empties his whole gun on him. Yeah. It's just, another one of those moments where we know that he does good and he does bad.
So Rousseau rushes the body and shock horror, it's actually Agent Muldrick that Doyle has shot.
And he doesn't care. He's just doesn't care. Oh, well, that's not the guy I was after. So reload the gun, off I go again. And poor Buddy is there going, you shot Muldrick.
Yeah, it was really weird. And then didn't it end with like a single gunshot off screen?
Yeah, so Popeye runs down the length of the warehouse, sort of turns to the right. Disappears off screen, there's a single gunshot and the screen fades to black.
So we don't know who we shot?
But then we get a nice little text thing about what happened to everyone in a weird kind of odd ending.
Well, it was at that point.
I love that type of ending though, that's great.
Yeah, but it was at this point I realised it must be based on a true story because I hadn't realised before.
It was a really jarring ending, but those things at the end weren't accurate for what actually happened to the people it was based off of.
Oh.
No, a lot of it was just, to finish off that story.
Incredible.
So, I mean, the shooting of Muldrick, I think, was one of those bits where it wasn't needed and I don't know why it was included.
Oh, well, it was included just to show how desperate Popeye had gotten. He was just doggedly determined, this just one track mind, and he just wasn't thinking, he was just reacting with his gut. I think it was important to show that just how far down the rabbit hole he'd gotten,
and it really vindicated all the people that had said several times during the film about the last time you were dead certain there was a dead cop. That's exactly what happened again. He became so single-minded and focused, and what happened was a cop ended up dead. Well, an FBI agent in this case.
Yeah, okay. I'll give the filmmakers that one, although I had completely missed that subtext. So, yes, we get to see the fates of the people of the film. Only Henri Devereux serving any real time. 4 years, I think he was in jail.
Yeah, in penitentiary for 4 years. But everyone else got away scot-free, pretty much.
Most of them got pretty much away scot-free. They say Charnier was never caught. Shania Nevercourt and Doyle and Russo were reassigned out of the narcotics unit, which kind of shows that, you know, if he was never caught, then he wasn't the one taking the gunshot. Again, this was sort of kind of shown by the fact that there was a sequel.
The ending for me felt quite unsatisfying because although, you know, they did their nice big... Like, that moment when they crested the bridge and all the cops were there, that felt satisfying. But then with the ending being that the French guy got away and an FBI agent got shot by a cop and it was all just kind of, oh, this wasn't the ending I was hoping for.
Yeah, I mean, if they'd ended it just as he crested the bridge and the row of police were there, I think that would have been a good ending point.
Yeah.
But I guess the point being that in real life he gets away, they needed to show that somehow.
Yeah.
And obviously if he is in the car and there's a wall of policemen there, he's not getting away from that without, you know, running.
So I thought this was a bit of an odd film to have been the highest grossing for the year.
Mm.
Like Dirty Harry came out just 6 weeks after this one and I would have expected that one to be higher grossing for a very similar genre. So I'm actually surprised that this did as well worldwide as it did. It also won Best Picture and Best Director and Best Actor and Screenplay Adaption.
Yeah.
Wasn't it the first film to win an Academy Award as an R-rated film?
Yes,
it was.
Oh, hang on. No, wait. There was something about...
There was another film from 2 years before that got subsequently downgraded to an
Midnight
R-rating.
Cowboy in 1969 had an X rating.
But this one was R-rated at the time.
Right, yeah, it got reclassified later. Apparently the body count in this film was 14.
A body... only 14?
Yes.
So yes, that was The French Connection. So any final thoughts, anybody? Joe?
Yes, I didn't hate this film. I think as I said at the beginning, I have no idea what to expect. It dragged a little bit, you know, sort of beginning to middle, but, you know, once it got to the train chase thing, I was just like, I want to find out what happens.
Yeah, so, I think I read somewhere that there was a first hour before there was a shot, but that's not strictly true because there was a shot within the first 5 minutes.
Yeah.
But it was a good hour between that first gunshot and then the assassination attempt, where there was no action. It was just procedural.
Well, other than cops beating people up in bars and things.
And someone getting stabbed with a Santa.
Not being stabbed with a Santa. That's an entirely different film.
Anyway.
Any final thoughts, Daisy?
Gritty 70s buddy cops uncovering an awesome conspiracy, busting a huge drug deal with car chases and subway dancers. What is there not to like other than the slow pacing early on in the movie? I loved it and I realised why it was that I have this on DVD because it was great.
Cool. Nice. And Sammy, what are your final thoughts?
My final thoughts. I wish I could... I don't know if this is weird, but I wish I could, like, time travel back to 1970s New York. And this made me want to time travel back to 1970s New York. Maybe not so much the drugs bit of it, but I just get really nostalgic for that city. And this weirdly brought that out.
It was very beautifully shot. So that's one of my sort of final thoughts, is that the cinematography and the actual depiction of New York as a city was, although it was grey and gritty and grimy and cold and wintry, it was ridiculously pretty in many ways.
It had a real sense of place.
Yeah, and looked really nice. So yeah, no, I enjoyed it as well. I agree, it did get a little bit slow when they were doing the stakeouts. But once it picked up with the car chase and then sort of the actual drug deals, I thought it was really enjoyable. Onwards to the next film, which is, I believe, some small unknown thing called Harry Potter.
You're a wizard, Barry.
Is the 2001 film Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone.
The version we will be watching is Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone.
It will indeed, although some of you who may be based on the other side of the planet in the Americas may well know this as Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. It is the same film. I don't believe there's any real differences other than the title.
And every time it's said in the film, they recorded two versions, so...
Did they?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yes, next time it will be Harry Potter and the Philosopher's / Sorcerer's Stone. Please join us for that. I'm sure it'll be wizard. My name is David Callier, and I'd like to thoroughly thank my co-hosts. Thank you, Joe.
That's okay.
Thank you, Daisy.
You're welcome.
And thank you to my lovely wife, Sammy. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, and we'll be back in 2 weeks' time with Harry Potter.
Thanks for listening.
Bye. Bye.
Thank you for listening to Home Movie Club, part of the That Podcast Thing Network. Find us on Twitter at @podcast_thing and on Facebook by searching for That Podcast Thing. Please like and subscribe for news of our future episodes coming soon. Yeah.